watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. For local listeners and the Finger Lakes, this program is airing on the eve of Memorial Day, a holiday created to remember those who died, mostly pointlessly, in wars that were portrayed as defending our freedom, but usually had a profit motive rather than a freedom motive. At least those during my lifetime. If it memorializes anything, it is the persistent lying of the rulers to the ruled and the tragic consequences of that. Why don't we then, on the whole, learn from this experience? I think it's because we're taught not to learn from it. Our schools, where we're taught not to think, play a large role by design in perpetuating the obedient attitude necessary for the survival of military and corporate hierarchies. The facts that would make us question them are carefully obscured. From the experience of my own schooling, I was taught outright lies, or facts so decontextualized that they had the same effect. Now, they didn't lie about grammar and spelling, or the Pythagorean theorem. History and other social studies were the propaganda vehicles central to the production of future cannon fodder for the imperial war machine. And there was a war machine. The Vietnam War was raging when I was in high school, and the boys faced a draft number upon graduation. But the indoctrination was not just part of the curriculum. It was embedded in the culture and structure of the school itself. So in honor of Memorial Day, I want to remember a rare teacher, Janet Terry. She taught a group of us how to plan a protest. All the students were required to attend events that were called pep rallies that were held in advance of football games, where the students were herded into the gymnasium and made to chant in unison in support of the football team. It was creepy, like a Nuremberg rally, with things like, "Go team, fight, fight, fight." We understood that the football game was a proxy for war, and that the rally was an exercise in groupthink, and we resented having to be present. Janet Terry guided us in planning a protest that would succeed, yet get none of us in trouble, because it would checkmate the administration. To refuse our demand or to punish us would have been to reveal that the agenda of schooling was not education, but control, as John Taylor Gatto has been laying out in The Underground History of American Education, which I'll read the next installment from in the second hour. We met with her after school to get her advice on laying out the protest. She helped us craft our demand that attendance at the rallies should no longer be mandatory, and that we should have the option to go to the library and study instead. How could the school deny a student's request to study in the library, she said. Our action, she told us, must be disobedient in a way that would make punishment appear ridiculous. She suggested, go to the rally, gather in a big group in the most visible place in the gymnasium, sit down, turn our back to the stage, and remain silent. We made up a flyer with our demands and call to action, which we passed out to other students. Janet Terry made sure all the teachers and administrators saw it, so that when they saw the backs of a couple of hundred students pointing towards them, They knew what it meant. That was the last mandatory rally we ever had to attend. I don't know where Jenna Terry is, and I don't remember if we thanked her enough. We may not have been punished, but looking back, she took a big risk to herself in teaching her students how to protest in one of the most right-wing counties in California. How right-wing? The school board wanted to ban Alice in Wonderland from the school library because Lewis Carroll was a drug user, and All Quiet on the Western Front because it was anti-war. A generation later, the same battles are still being fought. After having lived through a number of liberal and conservative administrations, so-called, what I have seen is that government becomes increasingly more intrusive with each passing year, because it can, because it has more powerful technology at its disposal. Turning the technology of control to the service of freedom is the topic of our next speaker, Cory Doctorow, brought to us courtesy of Alex Smith at Radio EcoShock of Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
This is journalist, tech savant, and science fiction writer Cory Doctorow delivering the Leonardo Lecture at Simon Fraser University in Canada, March 9th, 2007.
Hi, everybody. I don't get a mic. I'm Brian Lewis. I'm Dean of Applied Sciences and Professor of Communication. Welcome. We've invited someone this year who's really brought a special buzz to the event. He's a great thinker about issues that concern us all. And this came across my desk this morning. This is from the IEEE. This is the Spectrum magazine. It's called Me and My RFIDs, my radio frequency identification devices. He's had them implanted in his hands. I open my door, unlock my car, and log into my computer by waving my hand. You can too. And there's an article in here about how you can actually get your implants done. Very cool, he thinks. Let's see what Barry has to say about that.
Barry, Cory.
Yeah. Thinking of Barry right now.
Nice to see you all. Thank you. So, as befits this question about RFID before I go into the main body of the talk, I saw a great talk at the Usenix LISA conference where I was speaking this year in D.C., and it won the prize for best student talk and best talk overall. And it was a woman from the Netherlands who had, with her colleagues, built a device called the RFID Defender that could, first of all, read all the RFIDs on your person, second of all, selectively interdict them so that they couldn't talk to anything else, and third, impersonate them. So, by all means, get the RFIDs in your hands and then use them to unlock your computer and your door and your car, and I'll come along and I'll brush up against you and I'll log into your computer and get money out of your ATM, drive your car away and break into your house. And what's more, as people who've got RFID-equipped cars have discovered, your insurance company won't honor your claims because they'll say, well, you have an RFID-equipped car, it's theft-proof. Therefore, you lost it. It wasn't stolen. So, I'm a technology person. I'm an internet person. I was always thus. You know, 1977, we had a terminal in our house from the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. My dad was a teacher, programmer. And from the first time my fingers touched a keyboard, from the first time I used one of these network devices, I felt like this was going to be a tool for amazing things, for amazing worlds that would open, amazing emancipation, that I would visit places I could never go, that I would do things that I would never done, that I would find in the computer a source of power, and that not just me, but people all over the world, that it would level the playing field. And this was you know, an early intuition, and I'm not the only one who had it. There are, you know, any number of we cyber-utopians sort of kicking around out there. But at the same time, there's a whole different intuition that arises when you use the internet. Some of you are probably old enough to remember a time when universities would give out Whole Earth cards, punch cards to their students, and the punch cards would bear the legend, "Do not bend, spindle, mutilate, or fold." And students would wear badges that said, "I am a student, do not bend, spindle, mutilate, or fold me. Stop dehumanizing me, I'm not a number, I'm a person." There was a time when it really felt like computers would be part of the apparatus of the state, part of the apparatus of control, and that each of us would be given our number, and that number would be used to track us through time and space, and that number would be used not to benefit us, but to control us. And today, that intuition is alive and well on the internet, too. Security is a funny thing. When you're an attacker in security, you have all the advantages in the world because an attacker needs to find one flaw in the defense and exploit it, whereas a defender needs to have no flaws an attacker can exploit. So when we're attacking the institutions of authority using technology, we're always winning. But when we're defending our privacy from those institutions of authority, we're always losing. And so we've been fighting a winning-losing battle, this paradoxical battle on the internet, for years now, and it's really hotting up. And that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. I'm a big Mark Twain fan. Twain was an odd duck. Obviously, he wrote some very good books, and he had some very strange ideas. He was, you know, into spiritualism and drinking magnetic fluid and all kinds of random stuff. And among the things that he believed was a then-voguish idea about scientific determinism or mechanistic determinism. He felt like the universe at the first instant of its creation was like a billiard table with a racked triangle of balls in the middle and a cue ball sat here, and that first breaking strike with the cue told you everything that you needed to know about everything that would unfold in the universe thereafter, and that if you only knew enough about the cue and the cue ball and the balls, or if you could measure where they all were now and which direction they were headed, that you could predict everything that was going to happen. That, in fact, we didn't even have free will, that the whole universe was predestined by that first breaking ball. And it seems like a strange idea, this idea that if you just know enough about the universe, you can predict everything that's going to happen, that there's no free will, that there's no, you know, particularly in this quantum age of ours, that everything is predictable. But it's rooted in something pretty deep and useful, and that's empiricism. And that's the idea that you can track the world by writing it down, by observing it and writing it down. And it's not just engineers these days who know that if you don't write it down, it didn't happen. Cognitive scientists have really gotten in on the game. You know, they're the ones who keep releasing these hilarious YouTube videos where someone's being interviewed and then two people walk through the interview with carrying a large door, and as they're going, they swap the interviewer out and the interview subject doesn't even notice. Because our senses are so incredibly flawed, our brains are so selective in what we see and what we understand. Douglas Adams had this, of course, in his Someone Else's Problem field, that you can make things vanish just by making them so weird that everyone who sees them decides they must be someone else's problem, and their eyes just slide off of it and just as though it wasn't there at all. And I think it reflects this deep truth about our senses, that they are imperfect and flawed. And so we have always used recording the universe, right, tracking the universe to help us make sense of the universe and impose control on the universe. And that's, you know, kind of the story of civilization, right, is writing stuff down and getting to know it better. I think that we actually have a biological imperative to this. I think that some distant ancestor of ours discovered that if you actually keenly observed the antelopes and how they ate and when they rested and where they went, that you could catch more antelopes. And if you caught more antelopes, you could feed more children, and you could have more babies, and so on through the ages. And we are descendants of those early antelope scholars. And we have inherited their tendency towards empiricism, towards ascribing causality to the universe. Even when it doesn't make any sense, we try to ascribe causality to the universe. We talk about apophenia. This is the idea that people see patterns where they're not even there, so like faces that appear in clouds. And this is, of course, why people show up at casinos and go, well, seven blacks at the roulette wheel, the next one's got to be a white, and move all their chips over to it. In fact, the entire casino industry would fold if we had only a better understanding of statistics. But it's not just scientists or gamblers who rely on empiricism, or casinos, rather, that rely on empiricism. It applies to all manner, all corners of our life. Writing down what happens in our life is a way to make ourselves better people. If you should ever have the misfortune, for example, to declare bankruptcy, chances are the bankruptcy court will award you a trustee in bankruptcy, appoint you a trustee in bankruptcy, and that trustee will require you to write down what you spend, because that's the first step in getting control of how you spend. If you join Weight Watchers, the first thing they're going to make you do is write down what you eat, because that's the first step in figuring out what you're eating. Even if you find yourself depressed, and who isn't depressed every now and again, you might find yourself talking to a therapist who sets you to cognitive therapy, which is really just quantifying your moods, right? This idea of quantifying the world around us to help us better understand it and to help us gain better control over it, especially over ourselves as kind of physical objects. And I'm aware that I'm committing the engineer sin of treating the body as this kind of ambulatory machine that carts around the important stuff just north of the neck. But still, right? Understanding ourselves is something that we do with empiricism. And then there's time-motion study. This is the foundational science, such as it is, for the industrial age, right? This is Frank Gilworth and Miller and so on, or Taylor rather. This idea that you can observe how people behave and observe it in such minute detail that you can find the tiny inefficiencies and whittle them away until what you're left with is something lean, mean, and hyper-efficient. And of course, you know, Gilbreth, he was Mac, right? He was clearly disturbed. He would do things like time how long it took him to button his shirt bottom up and top down, and then he would pick the best one, and he would only do that. But this, of course, you know, obsession makes the world go round, and Gilbert happened to invent things like touch typing and surgical procedure and the modern assembly line. These all came out of this magnificent obsession of his. But time-motion study is a kind of liminal case. It sits on the edge of technology that liberates us and technology that controls us. Because while a time-motion study might help you gain better control of your work and understand what you do better and be more efficient and waste less time, a time-motion study is more likely to be applied against you to show the ways in which you are failing to live up to some nominal ideal, some kind of average productivity of the average worker that can be obtained under laboratory conditions. You know what the physicists say, assume a perfectly spherical cow of uniform density, right? Assume a perfectly efficient worker of uniform density, and you're not living up to that perfectly efficient worker. It's just as likely that time-motion study will be used against you as for you. And that's the rub. Does observing the universe, does writing down what happens to us and what we do, make us freer or subject us to more control? So, on the side of free, well, the net evinces this intuition that we can be freer, and it evinces it through a couple of mechanisms. One is much lower costs of collaboration, and the other is new means of expression. And both of these are powerful forces, powerful motivating forces. So I'll give you some examples. In the early days of the internet, there was something called Usenet. Usenet was like the message board, the thing we had before we had message boards. And it was managed exclusively by corporate, academic, military, and government computers. And most of these were funded, actually, by the American government and the National Science Research Foundation. And Usenet had administrators, and the administrators determined what you could and couldn't talk about on Usenet. So Usenet was broken into a hierarchy, an ontology of all human knowledge. You had recreation, you had science, you had talk, you had all the other subjects that they had. And then beneath that, you had subheaders and so on. So you had rec.pets.cats. Right? And if you wanted to create rec.pets.cats Persian, you needed to put it to a vote. And the grand old men of the Usenet would sit down and consider your proposal and put it to a vote of the Usenet populace, and they would make a decision. And if they voted yay, then your newsgroup was opening up. And if not, you're relegated back to rec.pets.cats. Now, there are a lot of reasons for this. One is, you know, there was this belief that by keeping discussion corralled, because, of course, there's only one subject that any comment belongs in, right? There is no miscellanea, of course. We could make better sense of the world, but also it was driven by a very practical consideration, which was that the government was funding all of this stuff, and every administrator, and this was largely not government work. You know, the stuff that people were doing there, they were skiving off. They were talking about Star Trek. They were making plans for beer bus. They were exchanging notes on how to grow flowers in their gardens and so on. And they were doing it all with government money and on government time. So no one wanted a lot of scrutiny on this. They knew that the one thing that would attract a lot of scrutiny to it was porn. Right? That was the last thing they wanted. They didn't want any parliamentarian or congress critter climbing to their hind legs on the floor and going, "Why are our tax dollars going to fund this smut?" and pointing to some giant blow-up of a, you know, alt.sex.something news group. And that kind of fell apart with the advent of the first commercial ISPs. John Gilmore, who is the co-founder of one of the first commercial ISPs, as well as one of the key people for having written Solaris and designed the Spark controller and founded EFF and a number of other great accomplishments, he was one day looking around at this, and he's kind of a libertarian by bent, and he said, "Why are we subjecting speech to advance approval by some self-nominated cadre of censors? Why don't we just open it up?" And so he did. He created something called the alt hierarchy, and anyone could create an alt news group. You could create alt.rec.pets.catsmaincoon or alt.rec.pets.large.maincoon, and then you could duke it out with the other person who created the dueling Maine Coon news group, and you could argue about which one the Maine Coons were going to, and chances are everyone would CC everything to everything. And in a matter of seconds, the alt hierarchy had dwarfed the rest of Usenet. It had grown orders of magnitude larger than it. And it didn't melt down. Eventually, the whole Usenet melted down, and you know, there are lots of factors that caused that. But the universe didn't come to a screeching halt because anyone could talk about anything on Usenet. In fact, people talked about stuff that no one ever thought anyone would ever want to talk about on Usenet. My favorite example of this is a news group called alt.pave the earth. Right? Alta Pave the Earth was a group of people who were engaged in very serious technical discussions of the merits, demerits, and game plan for paving the entire Earth's surface and racing performance motorcycles on it. Down to things like, well, you know, what if you reduce the net energy state of the lubricating layers between the continental shelves and the mantle beneath them? Mightn't you adversely affect the Earth's core, change our polarity, and strip the instruments on our high-performance motorcycles? Well, the interesting thing about Usenet is it radically dropped the cost of finding people who had the same strange passing fancies as you. Right, every one of us has every now and again had a strange passing fancy. You know, what if we race performance motorcycles on the universe? Or what if I, you know, took my own spleen out? Or Richard Francis Burton, the guy who was the first European to go to Mecca, circumcised himself at the age of 35. You know, many of us have had lots of passing fancies as time goes by, but they tend to be solitary fancies. If you opt to wear your underwear on your head, there are social factors that will come to bear that will cause you to return to the normative state of society. That's just kind of as how it goes. And so it suddenly became possible to find people to undertake some form of collective action with, to find common cause with, in a way that was cheaper and easier than it had ever been before. And this is, of course, one of the great problems of collective action, is just finding other people who share your ideas, you know, the love that dare not speak its name. You know, who else out there feels the way I do and wants to come with me to the barricades? And who, if I espouse this belief, will snub me or ostracize me or attack me or rat me out, throw me in jail and what have you? That's a very expensive and hard process in social groups. And yet the internet dropped the cost of that so low that it was practically zero, just by opening these alt hierarchies. And of course, it got even cheaper than that, because setting up an alt hierarchy by contemporary standards, setting up an alt hierarchy is like performing rockets, you know, building a rocket from scratch and actually launching a satellite with it. It's insanely, transcendently complex, though at the time, it seemed pretty easy relative to convincing the entire Usenet to allow your group to exist. People are hard, technology is easy. But now we have blogs, right? And blogs are so much easier than the news groups, that it seems like breathing to start a blog. You just, oops, I just started another one. You know, I got giant Maine Coons, underwear on my head, circumcised at the age of 35. You know, just accidentally creating blogs, every subject in the universe. And the blogs, because the blogs link between each other and they express their subject matter in ways that search engines find easy to track, it becomes really easy to find blogs. Blogs have very, very high search ranks. When you search for subjects, the chances that a blog will be considered authoritative on that subject, very high. So they turn up a lot in search results. And so blogs make it really easy to attract people who have the same ideas as you. And then you have even cheaper forms of collaboration. So there's a company called Flickr that started here in Vancouver. Two friends of mine, Katarina Fake and Stuart Butterfield, and I was actually an advisor to Flickr when they started out. And Flickr stole a great idea, all great ideas are stolen, called tags. They got it from another service called Delicious. And prior to tagging, the way that you would do ontology, the way that you would figure out what labels applied to which, is through a process much like a Usenet. You'd have, you know, the grand old ontologists who would sit around and decide the one canonical way that human knowledge could be organized and then evaluate everything and stick it in the canonical box. You know, this was the way Yahoo started, if you remember Yahoo, when it was just a humble directory of every web page on the internet slotted into its perfect pigeonhole. And Flickr sort of threw that away with tags. What they said instead was, you just apply any label you want to your photos, anything you want. Maybe your label is me. Well, there are a lot of photos that say me next to them. They're not all photos of the same person. So we have collisions. Maybe you call it a cat. Maybe it's a cat. Maybe it's a pair of caterpillar shoes. Maybe it's a caterpillar tractor. Maybe it's a cartoon cat. Maybe it's a real cat. You just called a cat. I invented a tag recently. Nice parking, asshole. I live in Los Angeles this year, and it's full of SUVs that straddle three parking spaces. And so I take pictures of them, and I put them on Flickr, and I call it Nice Parking Asshole. And one of my favorite tags is something called Decay. I don't know who started Decay. All great ideas have no visible progenitor. Decay, someone just said, well, here's a picture of something decaying. I'll call it Decay. And someone else did it, too, and someone else did it, too, and someone else did it, too. And now decay is like this kind of real-time coffee table book, a photo essay on the subject of decay. Whether it's beautiful high-definition photos or high dynamic range photos of barns falling into grandiose ruin, or crumbled flowers, or someone's science experiment lunch gone wrong in the back of the workplace refrigerator, or a beautiful macro focus photo of rust and the exquisite textures and colors of rust blooming on some old steel stanchion. It's just decay. And the thing is that the decay people never met, never communicated, never agreed what the parameters of decay would be, never discussed it, never conspired together, and have nevertheless, almost accidentally, undertaken a work of collaboration that before the internet we would have thought of as virtually impossible. Right? Let's make this real-time photo book of meditations on the subject of decay, and let's do it by attracting amateur photographers to the project. And let's just wind it out and see how it happens. And let's make it available to every person in the world who has access to the internet for free. This is an amazing undertaking. So collaboration gets cheaper even than Flickr. Collaboration can be as cheap, so cheap that you don't even notice it's going on. So the way that Google understands the internet, I alluded to earlier when I was talking about blogs, Google understands the internet by making a copy of it, all the web pages, and then counting the links and seeing which pages have more links coming to them than others. Those of you in the Academy are familiar with this. This is how we manage kind of esteem and status in the Academy. How many times have you been cited? Where have you been cited? Who cited you? And Google does just the same thing, citation analysis. No surprise, it was started by grad students at Stanford who are, of course, obsessed with getting enough citations that they could get their degrees, right? So Google counts citations, adds them up, and takes the pages that are most cited and considers them most authoritative, and considers the pages that they link to have some transitive authority, stemming from the fact that they attracted a link from a heavily linked to page, and so on. What this means is that you and me and everyone else who's ever written the web, anyone who's ever made a link between two web pages, has collaborated with everyone else to create a substructure of the internet that can be teased out of it by Google and by all of its competitors who've since basically all adopted this strategy because it's such a healthy strategy for evaluating the internet structure. We're all collaborating on this great work of understanding and tracking the internet without ever knowing it. And in fact, to the extent that we know it, we hurt Google instead of helping it. Everyone who deliberately tries to make a link for Google to understand that these two pages are related, ends up making Google's index less valuable. Because, of course, today the internet is cluttered with link farms and search engine optimizers and blog spammers and Google bombers who try to do things like make thousands of pages that appear to all be independently managed, except they all link to one page and that page is about Viagra. Right? Or who will all of them take the phrase indescribable moron and link it to whitehouse.gov, you know, so that when you search for George, you know, indescribable moron, there's George Bush's picture. You know, all of these efforts actually make Google less accurate in its understanding of the internet structure. That to the extent that we actually try to collaborate, we are worse at collaborating in this field of endeavor, possibly the largest collaborative effort we've ever had. And the collaboration doesn't just stop with understanding the internet and making things individually, but it helps us undertake collective labors that are more tightly coupled. So if you look at things like YouTube and MySpace, they're collaborating first of all, they're providing a platform first of all to help us collaborate to make new works. Here's the song, you take it, you remix it, you put up the song, he remixes it, he puts up the song. I take a piece from here, I take a piece from there, and I put them together, and I put it there again. I take it and I add it to my YouTube video. Someone takes my YouTube video and strips it out and makes it into a song again, and so on and so on and so on. They're not only doing that, but they're also making it possible for these works to locate audiences and for audiences to locate the works. Because Google has dropped the cost of search almost to nothing. And that also means that the cost of find, of being found, is also plummeting. And so these works can find their audiences. You know, the business buzzword coined by Chris Anderson from Wired magazine is the long tail, the fact that we can find stuff that was otherwise so obscure that it never would have been found. No one would have ever bothered to promote a news group about paving the earth widely enough that the seven lunatics who are, you know, evenly distributed on all corners of the globe could find each other and do it. But Google makes that search cost so low that they can find each other. Google makes the search cost so low that the six people interested in that funny Star Wars video can find it on YouTube. And maybe they can find 60,000 friends who are also interested in it, because no one suspected what audience it had lurking in Potentia. We have even more ambitious fields of endeavor. Free and open source software is that software that works just like regular software, like Microsoft software or Apple software or Adobe software, but it has a distinction, which is that when you get it and you run it on your computer, you not only get the code that runs, but you get the source code, that is to say the code that you can use to modify it and improve on it. And with it, you get licenses that confer all kinds of freedoms on you, the freedom to understand it, the freedom to run it, the freedom to improve on it, the freedom to share your improvements with others, right? So what this means, how this nets out, is that you end up with entire operating systems, entire browsers, Linux, Mozilla, Firefox, the most popular mail server on the internet, the most popular web server on the internet, which is called Apache because it's had so many patches added to it that it's a very patchy web server. All of these things have been built essentially by volunteers, almost operating on instinct, almost like ants form hills or British people form queues, right? Like just kind of like wasps chewing up and spitting out the crust that you need to make that lovely hexagonal wasp pattern. And they do it, and it works, and it works really well. And they do it for a really wide variety of reasons. And of course, that's the mark of a true movement. It's just, you're just a group of people if you all do it for the same reason. If you're all doing it for different and sometimes mutually contradictory reasons, then you're a movement, right? If Al Gore wants to save the environment because you can make money and Earth First wants to save the environment because money is evil, and they both agree on saving the environment, then you know you have a movement, right? So the free and open source software movement has accomplished something incredibly weird and daunting. Imagine if you had a 40-story, beautiful, functional office tower built by volunteers like a barn raising who found out about it by flyers stapled to telephone poles, right? This is the scale of a free and open source operating system, a free and open source web server, a free and open source mail server or browser. That's the scale of these endeavors. And these endeavors are being done so cheaply in terms of their collaboration that they've challenged all of our notions about what can and can't be done through volunteer efforts and through uncoordinated or loosely coordinated efforts. The internet makes it really hard to control communication. In fact, it seems like communication seeps through the cracks no matter what you do. So, for example, I write columns for a magazine called Information Week, which is targeted at chief information officers. Right, so my editor, a guy named Mitch Wagner, he writes a weblog for Information Week with information for CIOs, right? Should you upgrade to Vista? How should you configure your firewall? Has this company got a better service package than that company? So one day, he finds on his message board, where he's been writing about this stuff, you know, comment about a web server, two 9-year-old girls talking about whether or not Kaylee is a skank and did you see what she was wearing at recess? And Mitch says, can I ask what you people are doing here? And they say, oh yeah, well, you know, our school blocks all message boards, it blocks MySpace, it blocks IM, and so on, so we use your message board. And it seems like people will use technology to seize freedom faster than we can wall it off. I mean, this is that attacker-defender thing again. When you're attacking the mechanisms of control, you merely have to find one error, whereas the control needs to make no mistakes. So back in the 80s, at the dawn of the personal computing era, computing in the workplace was dominated by mainframes, and mainframes were dominated by a priesthood of engineers who wore white lab coats and decided with management which screens you were allowed to look at and how you were allowed to parse the data that appeared on them. And along came the PC, the Apple II Plus, and the first spreadsheets, VisiCalc, Lotus 1-2-3. And these people, and people who used them, discovered that if they were given the autonomy to rearrange the data according to their own needs, now this seems like trivial today, right? If you had the autonomy to run a spreadsheet, but yes, if you had the autonomy to run a spreadsheet and change the way the data was presented to you, you could find new efficiencies in your job. You could perform better than you ever could before. You could find an efficiency that no Gilbreth, no Taylor would have discovered in their quest to photograph you as you typed on your keyboard and discover where you were making mistakes. And they got fired for bringing in these PCs, smuggling them in, hiding them under their desks, and munging the data the way that they wanted to munge it. Right? It was considered a security risk to take data out of the big mainframe and make it all slithery and slippery and mobile on a floppy disk. You know, those big five and a quarter inch unwieldy floppies, which in those days was like Quicksilver compared to one of those giant mini computers or mainframes. And years later, decade later, those same workplaces had a new priesthood, and the priesthood didn't control the computer, they controlled the firewall. And they decided what protocols you could run. And they blocked sending attachments out of the firewall, they blocked IMing with people, you could only use the internal IM, and so on. And employees treated systems administrators as damaged and routed around them. And they downloaded Yahoo Messenger, they got Hotmail accounts, they used peer-to-peer software and web message boards to communicate with clients, to communicate with each other, right? When the network, when the internal services being provided don't work, you use the external services. This is why in my classes we threw away Blackboard and we use Google Blogs, because they work and Blackboard doesn't. And so those same employees had the same problem, right? They suddenly found themselves being cracked down on by the same priesthood, the spiritual descendants of that priesthood, who wanted to, them to know that it was a terrible security risk to do your job, to effectively manage data in the way that was most useful to you. So the internet informs this ideology that more control is less efficient and less effective, that the more control you add, the less efficiency you get. Call it the pointy-haired boss syndrome. So here's an example of that. You're probably familiar at least a little with the network neutrality debate. I call it a debate, although that's dignifying the other side's arguments, which are such visible, self-serving horseshit that it's amazing to even think that they get an airing. But the idea here is that internet service providers should be able to distinguish, should be able to discriminate against the people who provide network services, websites, and so on. They should be able to pick which websites you get to look, get to serve you pages, and how efficiently they get to serve you pages, based on how much money they can collect in bribes. As Craig Newmark from Craigslist said, imagine if you picked up the phone and dialed your local pizzeria, and they said, "I'm sorry, the local pizzeria hasn't paid us any blood money this month, so you can either wait 5 minutes to talk to them, or we can connect you to Pizza Pizza, with whom we have a business relationship right now." And the network operators argue that this will allow them to roll out better services, because there are some services that require that the whole network be devoted to them, video on demand services, and so that they'll be able to provide those much better if they can discriminate against all the other services that don't pay them their blood money. And weirdly enough, telco regulators, who not incidentally walk straight into their government jobs and into telecoms jobs, are believing this. So we do have some facts on the ground in this debate. There are people who tried network discrimination. In particular, there's a shadow internet, a network from the future called Internet 2 that's run by academic institutions around the world that runs on incredibly high-speed pipes, pipes that make the stuff that we use at home look like tin cans and string. And those pipes run on an advanced protocol called IPv6, and it's more advanced than what we use, and it allows people to discriminate against traffic, against certain kinds of traffic in a really easy way, to prioritize them using what's called quality of service mechanisms. And you probably are familiar with the American senator who kind of runs this show, a guy named Ted Stevens, who's approximately 7 million years old and is the chairman of the committee that runs the internet. And I have no no problem with people wanting to get involved with the internet, and I have no doubt that there are people of all generations who are incredibly savvy about the internet. I know some of those people, and they're great. Ted Stevens isn't one of those people. Ted Stevens recently held hearings on network neutrality, in which he described the internet as not a truck but a series of tubes, and the internet that his staffer had sent him on Friday didn't arrive until Monday because it was filled with commercial video, and that's why we need network discrimination. Following that, someone who actually knew what he was talking about, someone who perhaps should be the chairman of the committee that regulates the internet, the person who is the public face of the Internet 2 project, stepped up to the plate and he said, "When we first began to deploy our network, our engineers started with the assumption that we should find technical ways of prioritizing certain kinds of bits, such as streaming video or video conferencing, in order to assure that they arrive without delay. For a number of years, we seriously considered various quality of service mechanisms, including having our engineers convene a quality of service working group." Surely, convening a working group is the first step to hell in many cases. As it developed, though, all of our research and all of our practical experience supported the conclusion that it was far more cost-effective to simply provide more bandwidth. With enough bandwidth in the network, there is no congestion, and video bits do not need preferential treatment. All of the bits arrive fast enough, even if intermingled. So in other words, it's cheaper to throw more capacity at the problem until there's no contention than it is to control the limited resource to make sure that it's shared fairly among all the people who are contending for it. Right? Control is actually more expensive than solving the thing that control is supposed to govern. Well, it's not just in network protocols that we find this. It's even in network services, so like the web. Right? Before the web, we had things like AOL or Alex, if you remember that Bell service that we had in Canada. It was like the French Minitel, and every time you touched the keyboard, it added another penny to your phone bill. And the idea was that they would make Alex high quality or AOL high quality because they would have like a central committee, and that central committee would meet with everyone who wanted to add information to AOL to create a new portal on AOL, and they would discuss it with them, and they would run it through their quality of service mechanism, and they would make sure that it was high quality, and then they would allow it to come into being. And if they didn't like it, it wouldn't come into being. And of course, you could know that it was all good because you couldn't make it without paying money, and certainly no one would ever pay money to deliver a low-quality service, only high-quality services. So along comes the web, and everyone goes on the web. It's a cesspool. The web is a midden, famously described as a midden by one of the early opponents of the web, a guy named Lehman, who was one of the copyright bureaucrats in the Clinton administration. He actually proposed in 1995 that there be a separate licensing regime for every copy made by a document that traveled over the web. This not like the copy and the cache and stuff. I mean, like when the server receives the request and makes a network buffer, that's one copy, and a lawyer needs to negotiate that. And then when it gets sent to a router, that's another copy. A lawyer needs to negotiate that. When it gets sent to a cache, that's another copy. The lawyer negotiates that. When it gets sent to your router, the lawyer negotiates that. Your network buffer, your RAM, your disk cache, every single one of those. It was like the 1995 Full Legal Employment Act, right? And yet, the web turned out not only to attract a huge amount of chaff, but a substantial amount of wheat. And it turns out that one person's wheat is another man's chaff. There is so much good stuff on the web, and it turns out to be easier than anyone suspected to find the good stuff. Again, those search costs are so low that we can get much better results out of the web. And, you know, AOL has just closed its walled garden because they couldn't sustain it anymore. It was so overcompeted with by the web, the public web. The midden, the cesspool, overwhelmed their carefully tended garden. Wikipedia. They said it couldn't be done. In fact, some people say it hasn't been done. I don't know what Wikipedia they're reading. Right? The Wikipedia I read is consistently useful, comprehensive, and most importantly, it fails beautifully. Who cares about how well something works if it fails terribly? Right? If I gave you a car that got 4,000 kilometers to the gallon and went 300 kilometers an hour in 3 seconds, but had no brakes and exploded at random intervals, you wouldn't care how well it worked. Right? So, yeah, Wikipedia recently had this tempest in a teapot. Someone had faked his credentials. People fake credentials all the time. For example, the chairman of WIPO, the UN World Intellectual Property Organization, the people who have the same relationship to bad copyright law that Mordor has to evil, he just got outed for lying about his age for 24 years. He faked his age of being 12 years older than he actually was so that he could get the job when he was unqualified for it and was about to collect early retirement. Right? Now, it does speak volumes about his character that the thing he faked his age for was to become a senior bureaucrat at WIPO. It's a little like that moment in The Breakfast Club where the geek character shows his fake ID and it makes him like 38. And they say, why do you want to be 38? And he says, I get to take up more books from the library. Right? Why were you faking your age again? You wanted to be the head of WIPO. Wow, well, more power to you. Now, the amazing thing is how this failed, right? How do we know what influence this guy exerted on WIPO over the years if it turns out that we want to turn around and extract his bad influence from WIPO and return it to the pristine state, the pre-lapsarian state that it lived in the garden before the serpent entered it? Right? We have no good way of doing it. It's like the food color has been released into the swimming pool, right? Now, how do we catch this guy who faked his credentials on Wikipedia? How do we get rid of all of his contributions or reevaluate them and reassess them? We click a link, and it will tell us every punctuation mark that guy changed on Wikipedia. Wikipedia fails beautifully, right? How do we know if someone, when someone gets outed for being a fool and having edited the Encyclopedia Britannica, do we have any mechanism for extracting their contributions to the Britannica? Can we even, and if we can we do it in real time? Could we do it in 1 second? Right? So Wikipedia is great. They said it couldn't be done. They said that to make a an encyclopedia, you needed to have control. You needed to have authority. You needed to have efficient social contracts that would govern how the encyclopedia was constructed. And it turns out that Wikipedia was perfectly capable of constructing an encyclopedia all on its own without those things. An encyclopedia that I find useful all the time, and I understand that there's some debate among scholars about whether the student should or shouldn't use Wikipedia. Well, no one should use the encyclopedia as a primary source. That's like using the dictionary as a primary source. You know, lead. Lead is a substance that is found on the atomic table. You know, my paper about lead. But you know, I assign Wikipedia to my students. I say, go and find Wikipedia entries relevant to the material we covered in course and edit them, right? Add to them, find citations that are missing, check the punctuation and spelling, contribute to the scholarship, argue with other people who are engaged in them. Pretty hard to plagiarize. I show up in front of all the other students, works great every week, and at the end of it, we have a better Wikipedia. So not only do I think Wikipedia is amazing, I think it's an amazing tool for pedagogy. So the net informs this kind of control equals inefficiency ethos, but it also informs a countervailing and very important ideology, which is the ideology that it's possible to add control at very low costs. So not only can the internet remove control and accomplish great things at very low control costs, but the cost of adding control is likewise near zero. You can just throw more cycles at keeping track of everyone's movements. Throw more hard drive space at keeping track of everyone's searches. Throw more CCTVs and throw the video from them onto hard drives, and then go back and examine the video forensically when some bad guy does something, and go back and have a look at it, and so on. It's a kind of sorcerer's apprentice mentality. You know, we never could have trained enough super spies to watch all those CCTVs without nodding off, but the computer will watch them. The computer will fetishistically count up every salient fact of our life, like the miniature sorcerer's apprentices running off with their brooms. That's what we can do with computers, or so it seems. So total information awareness. This was Admiral John Poindexter, his effort early in the Bush administration after September 11th. The idea was that because we'd had this terrible intelligence failure where having gathered enough data to discover that there were terrorists planning to blow up the World Trade Center, we weren't able to tease that fact out of it. The needles were too small, the haystack too large. Poindexter resolved to make a bigger haystack. Right, let's gather more data and more data and more data with even less discrimination, and that eventually if we just have enough data, we'll be able to make sense of the world. U.S. visit program. Well, so it always seems like we're only one step away from gathering enough data to make sense of the world. Like playing a video game late into the night, right? I'll come to bed in 10 minutes, I promise. I just need to defeat this boss. I just need to get over this puzzle. I just need to do this one last thing. If I just achieve this one last thing, it'll all fall into place. I've got 80% of the problem solved. I'll have 100% of it solved any second now. So we just gather a little more data. U.S. visit is the program that Canadians don't experience very often, thankfully, but other people do when they go to America. Most people who visit America have to be fingerprinted now and have their photos taken. So this program, in addition to treating people like criminals, has cost $15 billion and has caught 1,000 bad guys. Now, not real bad guys, not terrorists, immigration cheats, people with outstanding minor warrants. People who have been caught at the cost of $15 million each, right? $15 million per petty crook. And imagine what we could do, and this is all money that's been diverted from actual policing. All money that's been diverted from actual security, right? The national budget is zero sum. Only so much money in the bank, right? And that money is being diverted to catching these crooks. But we just need a little more information. Other examples where this ideology crops up, look at the web blacklists. So companies, there are lots of companies out there that provide these web blacklists. What they do is they hire huge boiler rooms full of semi-skilled workers who do nothing all day except click on web pages and decide a priori whether they're good web pages or bad web pages. And if they're bad web pages, they get added to the list of bad web pages. And then repressive regimes like Syria or China or Fortune 100 companies or high schools hire them and pay them to keep their employees from seeing bad things. And of course, none of these have ever stopped employees from seeing bad things. They have, in fact, though, stopped employees from seeing good things. There's lots of miscategorization in these. And in Canada, we've got it even worse. In Canada, we've got this totally bonkers program called Clean Feeds. And the way that clean feeds work is they've got someone out there whose job it is to find all the child pornography on the internet and then make a secret list of it. And then distribute that secret list to ISPs who will, in secret, silently discard any request to look at those web pages. Right? And that way you'll be stopped from looking at child porn. Not if you're trying to look at child porn. Everyone acknowledges that defeating one of these with a proxy is trivial, and anyone who actually wanted to see child porn would just get around it. Right? No, this is to stop you from accidentally seeing child porn, which is apparently a problem. Although, speaking as someone who surfs about six sigmas away from normal web surfing, I have to tell you that it seems pretty unlikely to me that you're going to find child porn by accident on the internet. I certainly nothing that's ever happened to me in all my travels online. But we'll have a safety valve for it, because although we'll have a secret list that will silently discard requests, we'll have an appeals process. So if you somehow figure out that your web page is being blocked, you can ask the Canadian government to appeal it. And, of course, there is no way to find out that your web page is being blocked. But if you find out your web page is being blocked, then you can ask the government to appeal it. If they deny your appeal, you're a child pornographer. But maybe that won't deter you, and maybe you'll ask to have it done, and maybe those pages will come back, and we'll be able to look at them again. Now, it's funny, because, like, I hate child porn, you hate child porn, no one likes child porn except for child pornographers, child porn is bad, and you know, I'll stipulate all of this, bad child porn. But we fight child porn in this country already. We fight it every day, and I'm glad that we do, and we fight it from crossing the border with our customs service. And what our customs service does when they intercept child porn is they stop it from coming in and they add it to a publicly disclosed list of child porn that isn't allowed into the country. And if you think that something got onto the list by accident, if you think that they're wrong, if you think they took a cursory look at something, decided it was a scene material, and that it should be reconsidered, you can petition for reconsideration. And it can be brought back into the country if you prevail. And indeed, this just happened. Many of you probably saw this movie, V for Vendetta, or have read the comic The Watchmen. The person who wrote that just had a comic book published with his wife, a kind of magnum opus, this three-volume hardcover called Lost Girls, which is a kind of erotic retelling of Peter Pan, The Wizard of Oz, and Alice in Wonderland. It's kind of Lolita meets Spider-Man. And it has all these kind of weird and very disturbing scenes of child sexuality in it, because that's what it's about. It's a kind of exploration of the sexual undertones in these books. It's a kind of literary criticism by comic. And it won all kinds of awards and critical acclaim, and when they tried to bring it into this country, Customs stopped it. They took a cursory look at it, and they said, no, this isn't the kind of thing that we want to have in here, and they sent it back. And because it was publicly disclosed that this had been banned from entry into the country, people were able to ask Customs to reopen the case, to look at it. And when Customs reopened the case and looked at it and read the books, as opposed to just flipping through them and looking at the pictures, they changed their determination. They said, this has great artistic merit, it has great aesthetic merit, it has great social value, it has been redeemed, and we are allowing it back into the country, right? That's how we stop child porn. Because all security problems benefit from public scrutiny. All security problems are tractable only with many eyeballs. As they say in the open source world, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. My friend Bruce Schneier, the security expert, says that any person is capable of designing a security system so fiendishly clever that he himself can't imagine a way of breaking it. Right? Like, I can design a burglar alarm that goes underneath my kitchen window that is so completely badass that I would never be able to burgle my own house. Now, that doesn't mean that no one will be able to burgle my own house. It just means that no one as smart as me about this subject or dumber will be able to burgle my own house. And there's always someone smarter than you. And this is why in security, we always disclose the workings of security, because the only experimental methodology for determining whether or not security works, the only experimental methodology for making sure that you've done the right thing, is to tell other people what you've done and check to see if they've found any flaws in it. We have data retention rules coming in all over the world. Obviously, there's a proposal here in Canada, a dueling proposal in the United States. We've been fighting it to a standstill in Europe. I mostly live in London, England. I'm spending a year in Los Angeles now, and I'm a Canadian. So we've been fighting it off in Europe. And one of the things that we looked into when we looked at the data retention proposal, which is to say that ISPs would be required to save every click, every email, every IM, every URL, everything, every search query, and try to build up this huge corpus of information about you, we just did a little math, and we figured out how many linear meters of DVDs we would fill with data from just the British ISPs per second as we tried to keep track of all this data. And we said, really, once we keep all this information, how will we ever make any sense of it? How will we ever use this to find the already difficult to find terrorist, the ever elusive terrorist, with even more useless information about innocent people going about their business? And how will we prevent the case in which the law is selectively enforced? As Cardinal Richelieu famously said, give me 6 lines in any man's hand and I'll find you a reason to hang him. Right? If I look closely enough into all of your deeds and actions and movements, mightn't I find a reason to damn you? You hope so. I like that. And of course, now we have these no-fly lists. No-fly lists are lists of people who are so deadly and dangerous that we have to keep them off airplanes, but not so deadly and dangerous that we can think of a reason to arrest them. But we are nevertheless sure that we need to keep them off airplanes. And this list includes 4-year-old children, American senators, grandmothers, and so on. The fallacy of the no-fly list is derived from a problem with understanding statistics. There is in statistics this idea of the paradox of the false positive. And the way that works is, imagine that terrorism occurs in 1 in a million incidents. Right? So 1 in a million people coming through the airport as a terrorist. And imagine that you have a terrorism detector that's 99% accurate. And you hook that terrorist detector up to a rifle over the magnetometer, right? And every time a terrorist approaches the magnetometer, it shoots him in the head, right? Well, pass 1 million people through the magnetometer. It's 99% accurate. That means that 10,000 of them get a bullet through the head, and 1 of them is a terrorist. 9,999 of them aren't. And yet, we take computers, and we ask them to take these incredibly ineffective tests, these loose correlative tests, that try to determine who's a terrorist, and we try to apply them to things that are incredibly rare. Like terrorism isn't 1 in a million people; it's way less frequent than that. Unless, of course, you expand the definition of terrorist, as we have been doing, to include people who demonstrate, people who look at you cross-eyed, people who don't return their books to the library on time, people who smoke a little weed on the side, and everyone else who's in some way socially unpleasant. Those people are also apparently all terrorists. The problem with all of this, in terms of security, is that when you're watching everyone, you're watching no one. I met my girlfriend at a Nokia think tank in Helsinki. We were there for this event, and we were staying in this hotel called the Torni, and it's the tallest building in central Helsinki. It's 12 stories tall. This is not a city known for its tall buildings. And at the bottom of it, out front of the front door, there's a little plaque that says, during the Soviet occupation of Finland, this building was KGB headquarters. After the KGB left, we found 40 kilometers of wiretap wire in the walls, right, in this 12-story building. Because the central task of any KGB apparat in Snitch Nation is to wiretap all the other KGB apparats to find out if they're about to come after you. Right? They had this kind of weird copper-driven Metcalfe's law where every time you added a new spy, every other spy had to buy enough wire to run a line into that person's office. Right? When you're watching everyone, you're watching no one. In East Germany, in East Berlin, the Stasi, the secret police, had a file on every single person. They knew who was screwing around, who was telling them politic jokes, who had a drug problem, who had a drink problem. They didn't know the wall was about to come down. Because when you're watching everyone, you're watching no one. And the danger of this stuff isn't that you'll be caught for minor infractions through some kind of robotic enforcement, though that's pernicious, because we pass laws with the assumption that the law isn't just what it says, it's what it says divided by how hard it would be to enforce what it says. So we pass a speeding limit, but we don't expect that every time your needle nudges 1 kilometer over the speeding limit that you'll be delivered a ticket. Now in London, where I live most of the time, we've just brought in this regressive tax on driving, where if you drive in the center of town, you have to pay £10 a day. And the way that that is managed is they put a camera at every intersection that takes a picture of every license plate at every intersection in London all day long. And those cameras are also speed cameras. And so if you ever put the hammer down and you go just a little over the speed limit, in the post comes your £100 ticket. And that is quite pernicious. But that's not the real problem. It's not that robotic automated enforcement. It's that the enforcement will be selective. In the former Soviet Union, there weren't really a lot of laws against speaking out against the government or worshiping the wrong religion. There were just very stringent laws against black marketeering. But everyone was a black marketeer because the system was set up to make you be a black marketeer. It's a wonderful book called Homemade. It's Russian inventions. And they have little quotes from the inventors. And they said, you know, there's an entire chapter of things made from forks. These were the things that we made in the month that all the stores sold was forks.